please dial *611 for assistance.
We get signal, main screen turn on. You're listening to the radio program about Hacker Spaces. This here little radio program about Hacker Spaces.
Good evening. Welcome to the Hacktivism Hour. My name is Walter, and tonight we'll be having three interviews. One with a journalist who's been under criminal investigation for researching public transport chip cards. Another one about Tor servers, and the last one about the crowdsourcing of the Iceland.
We'll be right back.
just listened to Bertie Cox with Remember from his album The Signal, and to Gobo Dobro with the song Do Something from the album Little Country Boy. Anyway, it's been over a month ago that we had an Activism Hour. Right now this is a pre-recorded show. The hackerspace in The Hague got burglared, got a lightning strike, and we got some issues with equipment, and therefore this awful pre-recording. Anyway, one of the things in the news was that investigating the security of a, let's say, very much controversial public transport RFID scheme can end up in the sights of the public prosecutor. And that happened to Brenno de Winter, investigative journalist, and we talked to him for about 15 minutes. And let's roll the interview right now. Welcome to the show again.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, explain to our listeners abroad what the OV chip card is about.
Well, the OV chip card is the replacement of the paper ticket in the Netherlands. Basically, what they've done is introduce a card that is a small purse, and you carry money on it digitally, and you check in a bus or a subway or any way of transportation, and after so many miles you check out again, and there's a little bit of money subtracted from it. The system has been built in a very average way, to put it politely. And that means that the project is filled with errors. It costs a lot more than anticipated. It's still not working. And worst of all, it turns out to be an insecure system.
Yes, and that's the reason we got you on the show. After the manufacturer of the chips on the card, NXP, sued University of Nijmegen and lost a few years ago, now it's your turn to be sued, but now by the company who's implementing this contactless card scheme for public transport, and basically you're under investigation by the Dutch police on your involvement in hacking this card. Is that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. What happened was that for 4 years I've been writing about this issue and explaining what the problems are, and after 4 years, basically the opinion was, well, it's not all that bad. It's very hard to commit fraud. If you want to travel, that's virtually impossible. And I've always been very consistent in saying, no, it's not impossible. There's even standard software out there. So be aware and be careful. And after all that didn't work, at a certain point in January, I decided to take the software that's available in the internet and give a proof of concept, proving basically three things. First of all, that the card sucks, but basically that was known already. Second of all, that the back office that should detect the fraud is basically failing. And to do that, you have to generate a whole bunch of transactions where the back office is not able to detect it. And third of all, is basically that the system as a whole is failing, not detecting things that they should detect, not having multiple layers of security.
So, to what extent was you personally involved, were you personally involved in this proof of concept, or is this something which you're not supposed to answer the questions to, given that you have been interrogated by the police?
I have been interrogated by the police, and we'll get to that in a second, but I've been very open about it. That's the whole thing. It's not a secret that I downloaded the software that was available in the on the internet and used it. So I demonstrated that on television on a lot of shows, actually. We've talked about it on numerous radio shows. All newspapers were writing about it. So it was totally out in the open that this was being done. And the thing with the district attorney office right now is that the company behind the card has pressed charges for abusing cards. The funny thing is that they have been made aware that it were journalists doing this for journalistic reasons.
And what was the interrogation about? What kind of questions have been asked of you?
Basically, why I did it, what is the importance for journalism and that type of stuff. Also, they had only one charge when we were invited. And at the beginning of the interrogation, they added two charges. One is hacking, and the other one is having tools to manipulate value cards. And I already knew about the charge being in the possession of using changed value cards. So basically what they did was charging me with three offenses for riding the bus for free.
So you've been, you're considered a fair dodger?
Yes. No. Actually, that's the one charge I didn't get. That would be the logic charge, because then you would pay a €70 fine if you were found guilty, and that's the end of it. That would be the logic thing. The thing now is that because it's an electronic system, they are using all hacking type related crimes to get after you, and they are charging me with offenses that are punishable up to 6 years in prison.
Which is not a lovely thing to do, to say the very least. You mentioned being in possession of tools to manipulate debit cards, basically, or electronic money
purses,
cards.
Yes.
Electronic purses. My understanding from your TV show and your presentations in the past is that you were using standard off-the-shelf hardware, and I was about to buy a Galaxy Nexus 2, which contains a NXP chipset for reading near-field communications cards. So if I were to do so, I would be in possession of a tool to commit fraud, basically.
Exactly, and that would still be an option for me, that if they were to take it to court, that you press charges against Galaxy S users or Nexus, what is it, the Nexus, the new Google phone.
Yeah, it's well, we're not supposed to mention brand names, actually, I think. Well,
why not?
That's an subject for an entirely different show, Brenno. We'll get back later to that. But technically speaking, we're falling under Dutch media legislation if you do a streaming radio station from the Netherlands. But let's get back to the topic. Did they mention anything about the fact that this is typical dual use stuff? Actually, it was for sale on some specialty electronic stores. Are they going after them, or?
No, that's a remarkable thing. Since I was the journalist who investigated it, they are only going after me, not after the national news, not after a lot of regional news groups, not after newspapers or online websites, only after me.
There were rumors a few weeks ago that Tilt Translink Systems, the company behind this apparently flawed scheme, was also trying to get charges pressed against a professor of the University of Amsterdam.
I'm not aware of that. That is really news to me. They did send her a cease and desist letter, and they were threatening her in the past, but I don't know if they pressed charges, actually.
Okay, well, those were the rumors I heard, so, well, again, probably mostly hearsay.
Well, that's pretty interesting, because if they were to do that, then basically they've lost all control of the entire case.
I may have misunderstood, though.
Let's keep it at a cease and desist letter.
Yeah, which is funny in itself, given the already existing jurisprudence about the Nijmegen University bit.
But it's a cool thing to have. I've got a cease and desist letter of them, so it's a cool thing to have.
Always nice to tell your grandchildren when they can't catch any sleep, I would say. But to get back to you were interrogated in the presence of your lawyer. That must be a not so cheap pastime, for especially given that you're a freelance journalist.
No, this whole incident has already costed me €3,000. Just before we start our recording, the Dutch Federation of Journalists announced that they will pick up the large part of the tab, as well as a bunch of publications that will start a fundraiser online.
So, and by the time this gets broadcast, it will be in the past. What website should people go to when they want to donate money to the Save Brenno Fund?
Actually, I'm not aware of the site just yet, but freebrenno.nl is one of the sites that is currently being reserved for supporting actions.
So, well, let's hope you get enough money to keep the support of a lawyer who actually knows how to turn off turn on a computer instead of just your generic run-of-the-mill lawyer. Is there any idea on what will be the next step from the public prosecutor?
Well, actually, I was very hopeful that that they would drop the charges one day after the hearing interrogation. I made a very elaborate statement about the journalistic importance. It was a 13-page statement, and we added 7 pages during the interrogation. So I've been very vocal about what happened, why it was needed, etc. But to my amazement, the district attorney office decided to start another investigation into the behavior. And this is really killing for journalists. You have to imagine that during this process, you're not as free to talk about this subject. It hinders you in doing your job. It costs you a shitload of money and a shitload of time. All for ultimately having to drop the charges or acquitting me, because we've got plenty of jurisprudence that that you are allowed as a journalist to violate the law if there is no other option. And there is no other option to test the back office but to do it, because the company that is responsible is not very vocal when you ask questions.
So this lack of transparency might actually indeed justify your actions from the past. Have you considered countersuing?
I have considered it, but at this point that would be way too early. Also, then you have to think suing. Who should you sue? Is that the director? Is that the company itself? Where should I sue? Would that be in the Netherlands? Would that be in the United States, since I write for US publications as well? So it's kind of complex, and it's way too early. At this point, I just want to get the charges avoided.
Okay, well, let's hope the public prosecutor will find his mind again, or her mind.
His mind, yeah. And I'm very hopeful that he does. So far, I only consider him doing his job, because there are charges, and you expect, of course, the district attorney to launch an investigation. I hope that they choose the wiser decision of not going after a journalist and realizing how much it hinders me in doing my job.
Yes, but would it be actually helpful to you if someone were to write a Android application for this particular brand of phone I just mentioned?
Actually, those applications are already out there, so it is not really that I have discovered something very novel. Everybody warned already. If it helps me, I don't know. You know, it's at this point not very smart for me to make new points as long as you as you're in this case, and that is also me not being able to do my job again.
Yes, I do understand. Well, I just wish you all the best, and let's see how this turns out. I may bother you later on in the coming weeks again with interview requests. And the final question is, when will you start your show on Signal?
Well, I was supposed to do that this week, actually, but this got in the way of it. So that's the downside of it. Hopefully as soon as possible, and as soon as all the threats against me are away. And people do have to realize that even though I'm a journalist, it is a very realistic option that I still end up in jail during this investigation. And that's something I really, really fear.
Okay, well, yeah, another reason, because Brenno also is a member of a hackerspace in Arnhem called Hash 42, yep. And all people in the Dutch hackerspace and outside send money to the Free Brenno Fund on freebrenno.nl. Thank you so much for being here. And
can I ask one more question?
Yes, of course.
What would be helpful if security experts wrote letters of support indicating that this type of research helps improve the security of systems and is really needed? What you need to show the district attorney as well is that he's pursuing something that is basically not worth their time because you're actually improving security.
Okay, great. And a call to security experts for testimonies in favor of this. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
With all the gold and money burns our souls, that's the way it goes in the life we chose. Bullet is hard for a target of God to shoot off the man in charge of the land. Hey little man, take a look at life. Like you, we need something to buy. Look in my billfold, and you can tell that's true. You take to the poor and give it to your core. Betray voting masses for benefits and ease. And the bullet is hard for a target of God to shoot off the man in charge of the land. Little man, take a look at lives. We're a lot like you. We need something to buy. You look in my billfold, and you can tell that's true.
Bye.
interview with Brenno was followed by the group Cynical Sense from their album The Dead of Other Man, and the song was called Little Man. And after that we got a always popular song, Do It Over by Emily. And of course there has been some news in the last time. The Netherlands voted in net neutrality, which is a good thing in my book. In Denmark they want to introduce a ban on anonymity on the internet. Well, basically they want to ban anonymous access to the internet. Another interesting one is that the OECD is convening on the awful internet, and right now this is going to be a bit of a public relations disaster. Yesterday it appeared that no one of the civil societies involved wanted to vote or wanted to endorse the statement on the enforcement of copyright. And another very interesting thing is that in Iceland they are revising their constitution, and they're crowdsourcing that bit, including crowdsourcing it on the internet. And for that purpose I interviewed Smari McCarthy, also involved with the Icelandic Modern Media Institute, on which we did interviews before. But now we mostly spoke about the revision of the Icelandic constitution. I think it's almost a unique thing to have legislation drafted in this way. And mm-hmm. And let's kick off with the first question. The Icelandic constitution is actually pretty young. It's from the late 40s of the previous century.
Well, so the current incarnation of it is from 1944. But in 1944, what happened was they just swapped out the term king for president and made a few other minor adjustments. But what we really have is a constitution that was originally Danish, handed down to us in 1873.
So during the Danish oppression of your poor Icelandic
people. Yeah. And as a result, all of the political system is very well served for maintaining a kind of colonial suppression of the general public. And people have been saying, even back in 1944, there was the final clause of the Constitution as it is that the Constitution shall be rewritten no later than 1945.
Which I think was kind of ambitious given the geopolitical developments of that era.
Sure, but also, I mean, they not only failed, but they failed by a couple of decades. We have had, I think, six changes to the constitution since then. The biggest one was in, I think it was 1993, when the human rights chapter was introduced. But apart from that, it's more or less just the old Danish hand-me-down, which just hasn't really been serving its purpose.
So it's probably not a bad idea to involve the outside world. Second question, are there any Bolivians involved in redrafting the constitution?
Not to my knowledge, no. I mean, if that were the case, Bolivia tends to change their constitution on every 11 years on average.
I think so they're in their 44th or 45th incarnation of their constitution. That's precisely the reason I brought them up. They must be experts in constitutional drafting processes by now.
I should hope so. We haven't heard anything from them, but I mean, one of the things that's been done is every constitution that we can find has been pulled up onto the, and people have been flipping through it, just looking at the different constitutions. Somebody was pointing at a very weird introductory paragraph in the constitution of the Cayman Islands the other day, and you know, it's just until very recently I didn't know the Cayman Islands had a constitution. Another very eclectic one is Somaliland. So.
Somaliland, I didn't even know they had a constitution. I mean, the Horn of Africa is not really well known for its constitutions.
Oh, it's a very eclectic one. In some ways, it's incredibly modern and all sorts of really cool, like, progressive human rights ideas. Like, you know, it says in one place that life is granted to every man by Allah, and therefore it is sacred, you know, which, okay, I mean, there's a bit of a religious bias in there, but you know, they at least got that bit right. Then the next statement thereafter is, therefore it shall only be not be taken from anybody except with due process, basically.
Well, so it's reasonably progressive in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, so it goes from being amazingly modern and cool to being incredibly Byzantine, just in a matter of words.
I think that's insulting towards Somaliland. The idea that there's a right to due process is a pretty recent development in human history anyway. So
that is true, though.
They're halfway enlightenment there.
Yeah,
but that's, I would say, not. I wouldn't call that backwards or Byzantine. I mean, in Byzantine era, there was hardly any constitution. It's funny that we're discussing constitutions here. I do remember that the members of the Eastern Bloc back then had amazingly progressive constitutions. With zero results, and at the same time, the United Kingdom, at least England and Wales, still don't have a constitution.
Yeah. There was an article about the Icelandic constitutional process in The Guardian the other day, and a lot of the comments were along the lines of, like, you know, just kind of making fun of the process, and even the title of the article was, you know, mob rule. But Britain is kind of the least democratic society in well, at least this side of Europe. You know, it's
I'm not entirely sure of that, though. But
well, I mean, for example, after the most recent changes to the House of Lords, there are more members in the House of Lords representing basically the Lords than there are people in the European Parliament. And, you know, it's kind of a weird balance in that sense.
Yes, but give or take, maybe to Northwestern European standards, but I'm starting to being troubled by the amount of representative democracy in countries like Italy.
Yeah.
Even the Netherlands, having been around a bit in government the last few years, I'm amazed by the amount of power that the civil servants have. By the way, that problem is likewise in the UK. Yeah, that's not.
Yeah, and Iceland for that matter.
Well, given the small number of people in Iceland to begin with. There's probably more civil servants in the Netherlands than there are people in Iceland to begin with. So,
yeah.
But we're digressing. How is this? I mean, it's pretty progressive of Iceland to say, well, we want to consult the internet. Is that's not limited to Icelandic people themselves, I suppose?
Not really. I mean, so the way the process is actually being done is that it starts off with about 1,000 people meeting in a big sports arena and just discussing what the constitution should contain. And these 1,000 people were randomly picked from the census, and you know, it was a fairly good process. It was kind of like meetings where at the beginning of the meeting, people were doing very shallow, just kind of value-based observations. And then by the end of the day, they were coming down to very deep statements about what the constitution should stand for. And this was all collected into a big package and published online, and also handed off as a kind of guideline to the 25 people who were put onto the Constitutional Council. And the council itself was originally supposed to be elected. So there were 523 candidates, which is about 0.3% of the population. And But there were some formality problems with the election, so the Supreme Court annulled it. And the government did this really interesting hack. They just decided, okay, we're not going to have another election, we're just going to appoint people. And by sheer happenstance, we're going to appoint the same people as would have won if the election had been deemed fair.
And how did they know how, what people would have been if the election had been fair?
Sorry, I didn't get that.
How do they know what people would have won if the election had been fair, given that the election was annulled for being unfair?
So the 6 points which the Supreme Court used as a reason to annul it were all trivial issues, which none of them would have actually affected the result. One example is the way the wording of the law is when you receive a ballot, then you are supposed to return it to the ballot box in the same fold as you received it, and the ballots were unfolded. So everybody handed them in unfolded, and in fact they weren't supposed to fold them. But the Supreme Court says, well, there isn't any fold, therefore it's not valid. Another thing was that the voting booths had to be all the way up to the ceiling, but in fact they turned out to only be about 2.5 meters, or, well, maybe a little less than that. But, I mean, in reality, no chance anybody could see over them. So it was 6 little trivialities like that which made the Supreme Court, all of the members of which have very strong ties with the political party that appointed them. And oddly enough, that was the only political party that had anything against the idea of crowdsourcing a constitution.
And I suppose that was not one of the more progressive political parties, or?
No, they're more or less the same party as created the conditions of libertarian madness that led to the collapse here. So,
well, but libertarians tend to be in front of referenda and stuff like that.
Not around here. More or less, this party is called the Independence Party, and it can be neatly categorized into 3 types of people. There's the kind of modern libertarian Friedmanites who have an interesting political and economic theory, but are very self-serving in that. Then you've got the conservatives, who basically are kind of regressive, not necessarily very open to new developments. And then you have the third group, which is basically they're semi-fascistic. They're very much in favor of the police state. They introduced a lot of the things like data retention here, and are very interested in general just limiting people's liberties.
Please dial *611 for assistance.
We get signal. My screen turn on. You're listening to the radio program about Hacker Spaces. This here little radio program about Hacker Spaces.
From the skies, and someday I'm gonna rock the boat, and I'm gonna wanna know why it's a great day to be outside. Keep me up with your mind.
nous sommes tous frères. Changeons le monde en grandes assemblées. Établissons bien les priorités. Pourvu qu'elle place à l'Amérique. Ayons les mains de ceux qui traînent les pieds. Fermons les yeux de ceux qui veulent bien voir. De peu valeur que celle inscrite sur les dollars. Les piliers verts de l'Amérique.
Certain Death by Brad Sachs from his album Out of It, followed by United Nations by Drunk Souls from their album On Verra Plus Tard. And we'll continue with the interview with Smari about the Icelandic constitutional review right after this.
But most people do have internet. To what extent is there participation from all over the country?
Well, in this initial 1,000-person group, it was represented of more or less all of the country, even though there was a slight bias towards the capital area. But then, now that this council is working on all of these issues, there's feedback coming in from all sorts of civil society groups and people on Facebook and Twitter and YouTube and whatnot. And also through the forums on the website, and I haven't seen any statistics over what the distribution is, but I think that I've seen a certain bias towards younger people participating, and also people who are maybe more familiar with technology. So, in a sense, it's kind of becoming a somewhat technocratic feedback loop, at least.
So it's there's this kind of a risk of it being deemed an elitist law.
Well, I don't think that's very likely to happen. Actually, there's so many things in it that that are just very just interesting. For example, it's the first time I've ever seen a ban on discrimination by gender genotype. So, basically giving people equal rights regardless of what their genetic makeup is.
Which could be seen as an extension of discrimination by race, as is in many other constitutions.
Yep.
And it's also possibly the result of the massive research to the Icelandic genome, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, another part of it is just a greater acknowledgement of the rights of disabled people, such as people with Down syndrome or that kind of thing, where genetic makeup actually does have a role.
Yes.
Then there's lots of very interesting information rights that have been entered into it. For example, everybody will have the right to collect and disseminate data, and that's a very, very broad statement. You know,
isn't that kind of implied in the freedom of expression in the European Convention of Human Rights, of which Iceland is a signatory?
So sure, in a sense, but. When we're talking about, you know, there's been a lot of confusion generally when it comes to what is expression when you're online, for example. Where does it stop being expression and start being, for example, protocol? Do you have the right to receive TCP packets? You know, do you have the right to be broadcasting TCP packets? Because you certainly have a right to speech. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that all forms of speech can be guarded and facilitated by that kind of general rule. So this is kind of, in one sense, it's moving towards a more enlightened by the way the current understanding of information and how the universe works, and also it's kind of bridging some of the gap between secrecy and privacy and that subtle line that we keep trying to draw between it.
Yeah. Iceland is also in the process of becoming part of the European Union instead of being a mere EFTA, European Free Trade Agreement member.
And the EEA, of course. European Economic Area.
Yeah, that's the same thing, I think.
No. So Switzerland is a member of EFTA, but not of EEA, for example.
Okay.
There's a very good Venn diagram on Wikipedia.
You learn something new every day. And indeed, I should peruse Wikipedia before asking such a dumb question, perhaps. Interestingly enough, for example, I know that some Eastern European states used their negotiation position to opt out from certain directives when they came into the Union.
Yeah.
So did Poland. And, and the reason I'm bringing this up, anything you put in the Constitution may or may not be overruled by European law later on. Is anyone guarding that bit?
Generally speaking, it seems to have been the case with European laws that that if there's a constitutional reason for a country not to adopt a directive, then that will actually be acknowledged. For example, Denmark, in the case of the directive on enforcement orders for uncontested claims, they basically don't have a constitutional mandate to allow such things, so they've just been excluded from that directive. And I'm kind of hoping that we can use this kind of statement to opt out of things like data retention, but I'm not sure that the language of the constitution that's being written will be sufficient.
Well, one could easily argue that the data retention directive is in violation of the European Convention of Human Rights anyway.
Yes, I've been putting together that kind of argument, as you know, in for the Icelandic Parliament for a couple of days. So I'm hoping that we can kill data retention here, you know, within a year or so. I'm really hopeful because we got basically everything going for us, except the fact that we're possibly joining the EU, which would actually make things a bit tougher. But
you should have joined the EU 10 years ago. You would have been in a much better position for this.
But then we'd be in a much worse position now.
Possibly. We cannot rule out that possibility either. Now, the reason I brought this up is, and of course, this differs from member state to member state, because in the Dutch situation, given that our constitution is largely toothless because we don't have constitutional review of laws, we are very much depend on international agreements for our fundamental rights.
Yeah.
Because you can have a law reviewed based on treaties, but not on the constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And by extension, we cannot say a directive is unconstitutional and therefore we can't implement it and therefore we can opt out, like the Danish can.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that kind of safeguard will become increasingly important as kind of the European Union continues to develop and eat up more countries. I think we need some kind of defense against this thing.
Yeah, but sometimes it's a good thing. But to get back to information society and information law, one of the beacons in circles of constitutional scholars is still the Constitution of the United States, although it's has been amended about 27 times, I think.
Yep.
Nonetheless, it's still considered a amazing document, and it includes intellectual property, actually.
Yeah.
And is that a subject of the revision of the Icelandic constitutional review?
Well, I haven't seen such a thing come in yet. One thing that has been adopted is that a thing which is kind of taken from the German constitution and weakened is basically the equivalent of their 14th article, that property must not be used against the common good. And I've been thinking for a while that, you know, it would be very interesting to see. In the German version, it says that property shall be used for the common good, which raises lots of very interesting questions. And I'm kind of wondering, like, can that be used to basically kill intellectual monopolies in Germany? And one way we might be able to find that out is if this goes through here.
That will be interesting, yes. It's kind of similar to what we did in the Free Culture Forum in Barcelona, which includes a similar fundamental paragraph. Of which you undoubtedly are aware of.
Another thing, since you guys got net neutrality just yesterday, I think it was.
There is still some tinkering on a perceived flaw in it going on. It's been a very messy vote, but the at the core of it, net neutrality will become law in the Netherlands. That's correct.
Yeah, I saw some people from Bits for Freedom kind of celebrating on a mailing list earlier. So, you know, congratulations.
Yes, they have absolute reason. They have done a wonderful job. Have executed an almost flawless lobby on having a very thorough cookie law in there, and to get the Netherlands to be the second country in the world to have net neutrality included in its telecommunications legislation.
It's great. So we were thinking about that here as well. We were trying to figure out how we could put net neutrality into the constitution, and of course it won't be in all of the details that the legal implementations are, but as a general statement, we've suggested that that there should not only be network neutrality but general infrastructure neutrality, which is to say that the same kind of neutrality as we talk about when we say net neutrality would also apply to things like the power grid, the water grid, that kind of thing.
Wouldn't that be more sensible to say, well, we have this freedom of expression, this freedom of movement things, and subsequently that implies this, this, and this? I would be kind of reluctant of including net neutrality in a constitution because, in a sense, it's technology dependent
Yeah, but that's why we wanted to go for infrastructure neutrality instead, because that, you know, regardless of how our society develops, we'll always have some key infrastructure, and making a statement that infrastructure must not be unfairly disbalanced against certain parts of society or
would that regulated. Include radio spectrum?
That's a good question. It's not something that was explicitly stated in the suggested clause, but it's entirely a possibility. That would be good.
That would be interesting at the very least.
Yeah.
I think we're running a bit out of time, although we don't have real time constraints at Signal. I would like to thank you very much and invite you beforehand to any new sessions we may have, although you probably will not be in Iceland in the near future, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. I'm leaving on Saturday and going to be away for about 3 months at least, so okay. Going to be conference hopping. I'll probably see some people there.
Well, would be great if you would make any recordings made, by the way.
I'll try to do so. Yeah.
By Alkema, and we'll now play some funk, Kung Fu Funk by Give On.
peur d'entrer dans la bataille. Il pousse le son de son Akai, qui déverse un mauvais sang faille à la manière de Zangukai, digne héritier des maîtres Jedi. Kili se justifie masqué, baigné dans un bain de sacré. Tu réponds.
We have Moritz, and Moritz is founder and member of the board of the German Association Tor Service. Moritz, welcome, and can you explain a bit more about Tor for the not so technically inclined listeners to this show, and also what the Tor Service is about?
Yeah, hi Walter, thanks for having me. Tor Servers is a non-profit organization, and we deal with running Tor servers, like the name says. Actually, the name of our organization is Friends of the Onion. In German, it's Zwiebelfreunde. So, from the name, you can guess that we're not part of the Tor project that develops the software we're going to talk about, but rather friends of the Tor project, as in we like to teach about the Tor project in a way like we're doing this interview, and we run infrastructure to help the Tor project. And Tor is about making it possible to anonymously surf the internet, to use resources on the internet, and to make it hard for people who try to find who is talking to whom and about the content of the information you're exchanging.
And how safe is that actually? Because I've read some stories about so-called Tor exit nodes actually snooping on traffic that tries to be anonymized.
The problem, if you're trying to be to communicate, is that there has to be a way of two participants to exchange data or information. So there is some connection between you and your communication partner. And what you can do is introduce so-called proxies, like the single one-hop proxy is the most prominent example. And if you're introducing more of these hops, more of these proxy hops, you're making it harder to follow up who's talking to whom. But in the end, your initial request you're sending to your recipient is visible to the end point of your communication net, and that's the exit server. So you always have to use encrypted protocols anyway on the internet. Like when you're using an open Wi-Fi network, a lot of people can join into your communication and monitor what you're doing anyway. So you should look at the Tor network as a means of communication similar to any open network that you might want to use.
Okay, and how resource intensive is it to run a Tor server?
The Tor software works as a client software. So the usual step user would take is just install the package. We have a prepackaged software for all the operating systems, and then you can turn on a mode where you allow other people to use your computer and your network to proxy their communication through your system. And then there's the third mode of operating, that when you're allowing people to make their communication leave at your computer. And that's where it comes to problematic issues, because for the network, for the internet, it looks like the communication was started on your computer, although you're just rerouting it for other people. So when you're choosing to, you can choose either of these operating modes, and it depends on what resources you have. You can donate to the network as many kilobytes or megabytes your line has.
Why would you become part of a Tor network in the first place?
There are a lot of people out there that need to be anonymous. There's a lot of stuff going on in many countries, and we're not excluded from different parties that are interested in our communications. And that starts with the more friendly way of looking at your data, is like advertisement and your companies might be interested in who is talking to whom to, like, address the issue. Then if you're surfing on Amazon looking at a book, that might be something that is interesting to advertise. And the other issue in many countries is that the government is interested in the communication of their civilians, of their citizens, to control what gets out or gets in. Like in China, journalists have a hard time taking out talking to citizens who are afraid of their government monitoring what their communication is.
Okay, and how many people are involved in Friends of the Onion?
We are, at the moment, we are 13 members. And we have three board members, and most of the work is done, I would say about five people are involved in the actual work we're doing.
And how many Tor nodes do you maintain between the 30 of you?
At the moment we run 10 servers, professional servers, and we have a total of about 1.5 gigabits of traffic.
And how much is that normally used?
The traffic patterns are equal over time, so most of it is used all the time. So we don't look at the traffic, obviously, so we cannot say what's inside there. But judging from the abuse reports we get occasionally, most of the traffic seems to be some kind of legit traffic.
Yes, you bring up the abuse reports, because of course, like everything, it can be abused. How often, or what is your what's the likelihood of it becoming a problem for it being used for spammers or other stuff?
It's not so useful for spammers, because the Tor exit IPs, the servers that allow traffic to exit, are public. The list of IPs is a public list, and they're blocked by almost any email spam filter anyway. And also the rate of sending email over Tor is not really a problem. And I've been following the Tor project for quite some time now, and judging from the one year we've been running this large net part of the network, it's really a very low abuse. We've seen like harassments, website comments left to or fun stuff people do, like script kiddies run port scans and something like that. But it's rare that really something heavier hits the Tor network, because I think criminals or let's say terrorists, they know better ways to use the internet. It's Tor is made for the normal user, and not so much for the technically inclined people. But the goal is to have a simple software that anyone can use, and it's free.
Sounds great. I know of at least one case in the Netherlands where someone was using a Tor exit node, and was now under investigation for child pornography. Have you encountered any such problems in Germany?
Our servers are not actually all in Germany. We're a German registered organization, and that's, I think it's a good step to found a organization, a proper registered organization that does this. I wouldn't run Tor exits from a home line, and we make sure that our ISPs, our data centers, are aware what we're doing. So the stuff that gets in, the police requests we get from time to time, are directly directed to us as the operator, and not so much they're not so much looking at us as an end user. And I know of a few cases in Germany where people got raided because of traffic that was exiting from their Tor servers, but it's going down lately. And from the few cases we've had, in like we've run very fast servers for 1 year now, and we have five police inquiries since, and one of them was about child pornography. And obviously the Tor network can be used like any other network for things like child pornography.
And how did the police respond when you explained that you're part of a Tor network?
They were in four cases they were already aware. They were just trying to find out if we keep any logs at all, because obviously there are some VPN services or proxy services out there that tell the users they provide anonymous communication, but don't and answer to law enforcement inquiries. But in our case, we reply that we don't keep any logs, and I have the feeling that they are rather happy about it in a way, because they seem to be overloaded with work and happy about it, any case that it can close a lead. And most real criminal investigations, they have a lot of leads, because obviously it's a real life criminal activity, so there's also some real life lead you can follow up on. So there was no problem. They were really friendly. They, in two cases, they wanted to have it on paper. So I sat down and wrote it on paper that we don't keep any logs, and that was that.
Oh, it's nice to hear. One gets the idea that the German police is competent, in contrast to the Dutch police, who actually didn't understand a bit about the case, I've been told. anyway, we have to wrap up a bit here, and I have one final question, or maybe not a final question, but almost last question. If people want to help you out, what would be the best way to help out?
There's actually a lot of stuff we need help with. It's funny how the Tor project lives from the Tor project, as in the developers of the software, are only a handful of people that are working on the code. And around it, the Friends of the Onion, what we are doing is, again, another handful. And we have over 500,000 users daily, users of Tor. And there is so much we can use help with, so I cannot even start on telling you what we could use. But feel free to join us on IRC. We have a Jabber channel too. You can find it on our website. Obviously, it's torservers.net. And we're always happy if you have any questions and you come by and join us. We're happy to help you, or if you have anything you can help us with, just let us know.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So this was this month's Hacktivism Hour. Thank you for listening. If you have any feedback, don't hesitate to email us on signal@hackerspaces.org. And I will launch you out with Rooftop Space Ride by Jill Carrier from the album Urban Dreams.
dial *611 for assistance.
We get signal, main screen turn on. You're listening to the radio program about Hacker Spaces. This here little radio program about Hacker Spaces.